It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and today it's the Great Bean Mystery. Did you know that a third of our crops won't grow unless bees pollinate them? Well, the mystery began several years ago. Suddenly, great numbers of pollinator bees started leaving their hives to do their daily work, but they would never return. Scientists were stumped, and growers, needless to say, worried. Well, today we're going to put on the bee suits, and we're going to meet the bees that may be the answer to the mystery, and we're going to meet the scientists behind them. Stay with us, Super Bees, and more, this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, today we introduce you to two queens, science's queen of the bees and England's queen of herbs, and neither one of them delivers what you might expect. But before we meet up with the queens, I want to check in with our wine guy, Josh Wesson. Josh is one of the original mavericks of the wine field. In his fancy wine days, he was one of the top five sommeliers in the world, and then the maverick streak took over. He turned his smarts to tracking down the little-known bargains. Josh, good to have you back with us.
Hi, Lynn.
If you could drink wines from only one area of France, which one would it be?
That's such a tough question because, of course, France, many people think, is the very embodiment of great wine.
Right.
Or at least once it was, before all the other places that make great wine came on the wine scene. But if I was forced to pick one region in France to drink from for the rest of my life and no other, It would be the Loire Valley.
You mean not the Bordeaux region, not Burgundy?
Nope.
Not the Rhone?
Nope, not the Rhone, not Alsace, and I'll tell you why, because the Loire pours in this great arc across the center of France, and it cuts such a wide swath from the very center of the country all the way out to the Atlantic that it represents and contains just about every possible style of wine, every type of wine you could ever want to drink. They make sparkling wine, still wine, white wine, rosés, reds, dry, off-dry, incredibly sweet. I mean, there are almost 90 different appellations in this beautiful, beautiful part of France. Ooh. I love drinking wine from there.
Okay, give us some examples, though.
You know, there are three places that the Loire is most famous for when it comes to wine. There's Muscadet near the Atlantic, where they make all these light wines that go beautifully with shellfish.
Right.
And then you move a little bit east, and you end up drinking Vouvray made from Chenin Blanc in the middle. And as you get towards the center, you're drinking Sauvignon Blanc from Sancerre or Pouilly-Fumé. But I love the little places that are just off to the sides of those very famous regions that produce wines that are exciting and dynamic and happily affordable, that are just incredibly food-friendly, but maybe aren't so well-known. And if you love Sancerre and Pouilly-Fumé, those are two iconic Loire wines made from Sauvignon Blanc. Right next door to those wines is a place called Menetou Salon. And right next to Menetou Salon is Quincy. And you've got wines from Menetou and Quincy that are made from Sauvignon Blanc, just like the Sancerres
right.
and the Pouilly-Fumés of the world. But they're almost a little bit racier, and they're certainly less expensive than those famous wines. And they have this wonderful combination of bright, mouthwatering citrus fruit with this stony minerality. And the minerality adds complexity, and the mouthwatering qualities make the wines fun to drink. And they're great with dishes that have high acid or dishes that are green and leafy, all kinds of grilled vegetables. They're great with shellfish. I love drinking them on a summer day when it's warm out because they're just plain refreshing, and they're just lovely. Two of my favorites, one from Menetou Salon, called Domaine du Châtenois, and it sells for about $15. You can find the 2009 widely available in good wine shops. And then if you want a Quincy, which is a little bit harder to get, but still available. The Domaine Mardon, 2009, Sauvignon Blanc, delicious, mouthwatering, and a great change of pace from Sancerre and Puy-Fumé.
So you mentioned that there were three areas, and one of them was Vouvray, which is a wine I like a lot, the white wine with some, has a hint of almost sweetness to it, fruitiness. What's one of the kind of wines you'd never hear about that's related to that?
If you just step off the Vouvray path, right, you'll enter a town called Mont-Louis, which is also in the Touraine and gets its name from the main city there, Tours. And this wine, Mont-Louis, is made from the same Chenin Blanc grapes that Vouvray is made from. And it's made in the same style as Vouvray. I should say styles, because Vouvray can be dry, off-dry, or sweet.
Right.
And one of my favorites is fruity but bone dry. So it affects this wonderful tension between this ripe-smelling fruit, but when you put the wine in your mouth, it's really, really crisp and clean. It's a neat trick, and it's made by the producer François Chédaigne, and it sells for about $15 or $16, and I love it as a kind of sexy alternative to Vouvray. Just lovely, lovely wine.
It sounds wonderful. So what about Muscadet? That's the one that's the super dry, crisp white that's made out near the Atlantic.
Well, there's no real stunt double for Muscadet because it's made from a unique grape, the Melon de Bourgogne, the Melon of Burgundy, which happens not to be grown in Burgundy, but that's the French for you. But there's a wine made very near the region of Muscadet in Semur that's sparkling. And a lot of people don't know this, but the Loire Valley produces almost as much sparkling wine as Champagne.
Huh.
It's the second largest producer by region after Champagne. And they make Samour Brut that is fantastic. And I have two favorite wines from there. They're very modestly priced, but they're just delicious and fun to drink. Bouvet Brut, lovely wine for $14. And the Grandin Brut for about $13 or $14. They're great alternatives to Champagne. They're sort of like almost sparkling Muscadets.
Ooh.
And they go beautifully with raw shellfish. Nothing better than sitting out with a big platter of oysters and drinking a bottle of sparkling Samour. It's as close to heaven as you can get without actually going to heaven.
Sounds pretty swell. Josh,
yeah, it is.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
For Mr. Wesson's wine picks, go to the website, splendidtable.org. We have an asparagus situation at the moment. Recently, I mentioned to a caller that I preferred pencil slim asparagus because they're more tender than thick stalks and that they cook more evenly. Well, in a couple of nanoseconds, asparagus farmers closed in, pointing out, not always gently, that I had misspoken. Well, with red face, I have to admit that they reminded me of some things that I'd forgotten. Marianne, who farms in Iowa, kind of covered the waterfront. The main point here is that size does not matter. It has nothing to do with tenderness. She explained that thin asparagus come from young crowns. That is the root base that the asparagus grows from each year. Thick ones come from older crowns. She claims that if thick asparagus are picked in their prime and handled correctly, they'll be as tender as thin ones. And they do cook as evenly. The other thing we should know is that most small-scale farmers don't have the ability to sort their bunches by size the way the industrial ones do. So here's my new advice. Check the stalks and tips for withering. Buy assorted size bunches if you want, but cook them the Fanatics way, which is revealed in the recipe Skillet Asparagus with Manchego and Sherry Vinegar. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. It does not take a genius to find something wonderful to eat in Las Vegas. If you have a couple of months' rent, there are star chefs by the dozen waiting to wait on your every whim. Now, what does take smarts in Las Vegas is what Peter John Lindbergh did. He dug into where the locals go. Well, he's the editor-at-large for Travel and Leisure magazine. Hey, Peter, welcome.
Great to be here, Lynn.
You know, I'm just thinking, in the old days, Las Vegas was not a place you went to eat. I mean, there was a lot of food, but it wasn't very good. Why the change?
Well, you know, it has been, I guess it was 1992 when Wolfgang Puck came and opened Spago at Caesar's Palace. That was sort of the beginning of that star chef invasion that you talk about. And since then, as you said, you know, you couldn't open a resort or a casino in Las Vegas without having this big all-star cotillion of name-brand chefs.
Right.
But big-ticket restaurants don't make a food town. And it's only been in the last few years, I think, that that Vegas has really developed a proper restaurant scene that, you know, places that you would go not just to toast your anniversary or your IPO or something, you know, but, you know, sort of those everyday places that are still terrific, kind of off the strip and not the big-ticket event places.
So where do you go?
Well, one of the great things about Vegas is there's such a great range of ethnicities and immigrant communities and ethnic enclaves all over the city. A lot of them well off the main drag of the strip. And for example, Spring Mountain Road, which is Las Vegas's Chinatown, that is just an incredible community. Such a range of different eateries and shops and whatnot. You can get everything from like Hawaiian poke to you know, Macanese Bakery to, you know, Filipino lechon pork. And one of the great places there is actually this wonderful place called Raku, which is a Japanese Robata place. It's open until about 3 in the
grill,
morning.
That's the grill, right? Robata is grilled food?
Yeah, Robata is a, you know, kind of mixed meats grilled on charcoal grills. So Raku is actually open until 3 in the morning, and for that reason it's become a big chef's hangout, but also because the food is just insanely great, really high-level, ambitious stuff. They have a daily changing menu as well as the Robata, so they'll have things like fried prawns that you eat with the shell on the head and all, just delicious. They have a superb tofu that they make in-house. They'll have like a silky kind of velvety foie gras custard. And then my favorite dish there is this poached egg that's mixed in with sea urchin from Santa Barbara. That's just, it's like hearty Japanese soul food, you know. It's wonderful stuff, especially if it's midnight.
I realize probably you can't make a great living in a restaurant in Las Vegas unless you are open until something like 3 o'clock in the morning, because people have no sense of time there.
Yeah, exactly. And by the way, this place is in a mini mall. So, I mean, you're way out in the middle of this place where you expect to find like a Jiffy Lube or a, you know, Bail Bonds operation or something.
And that's next door, right? The Jiffy Lube,
yeah,
and the,
exactly,
the Bail
right.
Bonds.
Jiffy Lube's down the block,
yeah.
Exactly. And actually right around the corner from that, there's also a terrific new ramen place that I found called Manta. That specializes in tonkatsu ramen, which is that deep, really nutty pork broth that they'll put, you know, boiled egg and strips of pork belly inside that really just kind of melt on the tongue. That's literally right next door to Raku, so in the same little mini mall.
Are there other areas of Asia? I mean, for instance, is Southeast Asia represented?
Well, there's a place called Lotus of Siam that does get a lot of press. In fact, they just opened in New York last fall, which was kind of a curious little reversal of the usual migration from New York to Vegas. They had developed enough of a following and enough critical acclaim that they actually came to Manhattan. But the one in Vegas, it is truly a spectacular place. And again, also in a little strip mall that you wouldn't even look twice at. But they have just some terrific real regional Thai food that's cooked by a Thai family that's owned the place for the last 5 years or so. Jonathan Gold had called it, you know, one of the best Thai restaurants in America in a gourmet article a while back. So it's since become kind of a foodie haunt.
So what kinds of things are they doing?
They do an amazing sort of beef jerky, an Isan-style beef jerky that is just really kind of mind-bendingly good. It's this dark, rich, earthy, marinated spicy beef jerky that I'd never really seen outside of Thailand, actually. That's one of my favorite dishes there.
Okay, so the trick is get off the strip.
Exactly. You know, this is one of the fastest growing cities in America for the last couple decades now, and it really is, as I said, a proper city now. So there is, you know, a life way beyond what we see as visitors and way beyond the hotels and casinos. So, you know, these little communities are pretty incredible to wander around.
Hey, Peter, thank you.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
Peter John Lindbergh is the editor-at-large for Travel and Leisure magazine. Now, that talk about Thai food reminded me of Chef David Thompson's tome of the same name and his killer recipe for Thai grilled chicken. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, register for our monthly book giveaway. Now, this month, it's The Improvisational Cook by Sally Schneider. and sign up too for our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and you might as well download a few podcasts. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with the woman who is saving the bees and England's queen of herbs. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Did you know that bees pollinate a third of our fruits and vegetables? You see, farmers contract to have bees moved onto their land each year because nothing else can do their job. Well, in 2006, the bees began disappearing in big numbers. This phenomenon, which also moved to Europe and Asia, by the way, was called colony collapse disorder. And it left experts baffled. Well, Dr. Marla Spivak is an entomologist and distinguished McKnight professor at the University of Minnesota. Now, she's been working with bees for decades. And on a beautiful spring day, we met up with Marla and the bees at the university, but not before donning protective bee suits, tucking our pant legs into our socks, lowering our voices, and moving a bit slower than usual.
Okay. So what I'm going to do is puff a little smoke in the entrance of the colony, and that lets them know I'm here. And then I slowly, all my movements are going to be slow.
Right.
So I'm going to take off the lid, and the outer cover, and what you're seeing are a couple of buckets. Because this is a new colony, we're feeding them a little sugar syrup to get them going until flowers are really in bloom. And that's just happening today, really. This is the first time we've had some really nice weather, and we'll have nice weather all week long. So pretty soon we'll be able to stop feeding the colonies the syrup.
So we're looking now at what are called the worker bees?
Yeah, you're seeing a few worker bees. They're female. They're sterile females.
Are they always female?
Yeah, it's a female society. And about 5% of the colony will be males, but they're starting to raise males about now and into June. And then at the end of the season, they throw the males out of the colony. We call the males drones.
Now, why raise them and then throw them out?
Well, the drones don't do any work for the colony. Their sole job in life is to mate, and then they die. So the drones don't have a stinger. They can't defend the nest. They don't have the baskets on their legs to collect the pollen, and they don't have a place in their... Well, they have a place to store nectar, but they don't forage for nectar, so they don't make honey. So they don't secrete wax, so they really don't do any work in the colony. They just fly out every afternoon when they're mature and look for virgin queen bees to mate with.
So just to give us an overview, what is a day in the life of a bee?
Depends how old the bee is. So if you're a young bee, between about 1 to 10, 14 days old,
right.
You would stay down with the queen, and you would polish cells so the queen has a nice polished cell to lay an egg in, and you would feed the queen, and you would pass her pheromones, which is her chemical scent, from her to the other bees. So mostly you're what we call in the brood nest, and you're feeding larvae, you're feeding your sisters, immature sisters, so you're a nurse bee, basically, when
and
you're
then
young.
As you mature.
And then as you mature, then you start... The middle-aged bees are the ones that store the nectar. So an older bee is a forager, and she'll go out and collect nectar, and she'll hand it off to a middle-aged bee, like a teenage bee, and that bee will then store the nectar in a cell and convert it into honey. And the middle-aged bees also are the ones that secrete a lot of wax.
And then as
and
they
then
age.
When they're about 3 weeks old, then they start foraging regularly, and then that's all they'll do until they die. And they die when they're 4 to 6 weeks old.
It's really short life.
Short life, yeah. But the queen's constantly, she's laying 1,000 eggs a day, so they're replaced.
Now, what's happened to these bees, the colony collapse disorder?
Yeah.
Can you briefly describe what that's about?
Well, bees are dying. It's hard to keep colonies alive anymore, and there's many things going on at once. So in three categories... The first one would be there's simply not enough flowers out there to support bees throughout the season. So these are flowers that provide nectar and pollen for bees. Not just in cities, but in agricultural areas, there's just simply not enough flowers for bees. And then the flowers they encounter are contaminated with pesticides. which can kill them or have sublethal effects on them or just combine poorly with poor nutrition mm-hmm. and a compromised immune system. And then bees have their own diseases and parasites, and all of those things just combine really poorly. So
it's been a combination of factors.
It's a combination of factors, yeah.
But it's been so dramatic, and it seemed to come on very quickly, and a lot of colonies were lost.
Yes, a lot of colonies were lost beginning in the winter of 2006, and it's been like that ever since.
Why do you think it started so suddenly?
Well, that's what we're trying to understand. And actually, honeybees have been in slow decline since World War II. And that's just the change in our agricultural practices, the use of pesticides, mm-hmm. the use of fertilizers rather than rotating crops with clover. And so all of these things have been reducing the number of bee colonies nationwide since World War II. But in recent years, it seems like it should be a new disease or possibly a new pesticide, or the combination of those things. And that's what we're trying nationwide. That's what all the scientists are trying to figure out.
Well, you're going to open up the
hive? Of course I am, sure. The bees are kind of wondering what we're doing here.
Yeah. You're going to lift the top.
Well, these are called frames,
right.
Wooden frames. And inside the frame, what you're seeing is this plastic-based foundation. The bees don't need this. They can build their own comb, wax comb,
right.
naturally. We give the foundation to them as a guide, so that they'll build the comb straight, because otherwise they do some artistic things and then you can't get the frames out. Now this frame, you
this
can see they've done a lot.
Bees.
And it's beautiful. So
oh.
now what you're... Oh, here's the queen, and we painted her. We gave her a dot of red paint on her thorax so that we can see her quickly. You see her? She's beautiful.
She is magnificent. She has a longer body than the other bees.
Correct.
What is she doing right now?
Well, she's freaking out because we just brought her out into the sunlight. But
right.
she's starting to calm down a little bit. And if you watch her now, she's sticking her head into the cells. And she's looking for a place to lay an egg. So that's what she does all day long, is go from cell to cell and try to find an empty, polished one that she can lay an egg into. She puts her head in a cell. Oh, she's going to lay an egg for you.
Oh, my.
She's laying an egg. Do you see her?
Oh, yes.
Well, she put her abdomen way down in the cell. That was
yeah.
it.
And she's now hunting for another spot.
Yes. When the queen lays an egg, she can, well, before she lays the egg, she can decide to fertilize that egg or not. And it's not a conscious decision like we decide.
Right.
But she's laying another egg. She's just going nuts here for
oh,
you guys.
Oh, my.
She has a sac inside of her where she's stored sperm from the males that she mated with. And as her eggs develop in her ovaries, which is why her abdomen is so large,
yeah.
she's just full of ovaries, as eggs develop and they move down her oviduct, she can fertilize an egg or not. And if it's fertilized, it will develop into a female. And if it's not fertilized, it's just an egg, unfertilized egg, it will develop into a male.
So she actually populates the hive as it needs to be populated?
Correct. But she's not really ruling the roost. She's not really in charge.
Uh-huh.
She's in charge genetically over
yeah.
it's her offspring. But the workers are making decisions. So if she starts laying male eggs and they don't want to rear the male eggs, they just won't. So
uh-huh.
they're kind of controlling the population also.
I see what you mean about social beings.
Yeah.
Explain to me how you began to work with the bees and attempting to solve this problem of the bees disappearing and dying off.
Oh, well, I've been at the University of Minnesota since 1992, and I would say the topic of all of our studies are on bee health,
uh-huh.
and mostly I'm interested in promoting bees' own defenses. The general concept of what we do is called social immunity, and this was a term that was just coined a few years ago by a woman in Europe,
mm-hmm.
but this idea is that bees have behaviors so that within the colony, the behaviors of bees act like cells within an immune system of an individual. So it's really immunity at the colony level. And when you're thinking at the colony level, then you think of the bees as like cells within the organism. Does that make sense?
Yes, yes, okay. It does.
So hygienic behavior is when individual bees can sniff out these little larvae that are
right.
sick. And they can smell them before the larva even shows clinical symptoms of the disease. And they discard the diseased larvae. And so that reduces disease transmission. Bee colonies are actually smart. You know, the mass of one individual brain isn't very big, but if you put the whole collective mass of brains together, it's almost the mass of our human brain. Now, they don't think the way we do,
yeah,
reflectively and things like that, but the colony is very responsive, and the hygienic behavior is a genetic trait. So some colonies express the trait more than others, so you just, when you find a colony that really expresses hygienic behavior, they're very rapid cleaners, then you raise daughter queens from that colony.
Mm-hmm. So the future?
Oh, the future. Well, I think, well, I'm an optimist. So for me, the future's always bright. There's a huge interest in beekeeping now, and that's a good thing. It's hard to keep bees alive, but the huge interest in beekeeping means that people will start paying attention to what bees need in the environment. If you're a beekeeper, you have to be a better steward of the earth. You have to pay attention to how many flowers are out there. You have to pay attention to the pesticides that are being used. And you start paying attention to bee diseases and mite pests. And once you start paying attention to what the bees need, then
the
world
changes.
Gets better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Marla, thanks so much for having us and for introducing us to the bees.
Thank you.
Marla Spivak is an entomologist at the University of Minnesota. Now, her bee research was recognized with a MacArthur Genius Grant. You're going to find more conversation with Marla about those fascinating insects on our website, splendidtable.org. Unless you're an Anglophile, you might not realize that England is obsessed with gardening. In that environment, Jecha McVicar is the rock star of herbs. When no one had seen a fresh herb in a British supermarket, I'm talking about 20 years ago, Jecha started supplying stores from her backyard garden. Well, much has happened since then. Jecha's expanded that garden by quite a bit. She now works with that family that lives in Buckingham Palace. She's collected the gardener's equivalent of Olympic gold over 75 times, and her 10th book has hit print. It's called Jecha's Herb Cookbook. Jecha, good to have you with us.
It's lovely to be with you. It really is.
How many herbs are you growing at this point?
We're well over 700 varieties of herb. And at any one time, I'll have 500 varieties available at this time of year. Obviously, it tails off towards the winter.
You know, I was looking at your book last week, and I started thinking about how many herbs, how many different herbs I might eat in a week. And we really have a pretty narrow spectrum, don't we?
Well, even I do. You know, with the amount I grow, I don't use them all. I have my favourites. And I think everyone goes through sort of favourite cooking.
Yeah.
You know, in the winter, I have to have my rosemary, you know, and I must have my myrtle and I must have my bay. But then in the summer, I will revert. At the moment, I'm eating masses of chervil and dill and, you know, mint. And it really does go with the seasons.
Well, you know, you mentioned an herb. I'm thinking about the herbs we rarely eat. And you mentioned you liked myrtle.
I adore
myrtle. Nobody uses myrtle. I mean, the only place I ever came across myrtle being used is Sardinia. How did you come into this?
Well, it is because of Sardinia. I have a wonderful family who have been incredibly patient with me because herbs are my passion. My darling husband was a spacecraft engineer, and my son and my daughter have grown up on the herb farm, obviously. But they, the three of them, love sailing. And I can't stand being on a boat. So our holidays, they all three of them went off sailing. And I would be in charge of food, which is how I landed up being a herb farmer in the first place. And I would get a bicycle. And this time I was on Sardinia. And Sardinia, for those that don't know, is very hilly. So off I set on my daily trek to see what I could see with my camera and my snips and everything else you know, that I needed for the day. And I was pushed my bike up this really steep hill, and then I saw this rock face covered in myrtle, and I got so excited. You know, there it was growing wild, and I was making notes, because once you understand how a plant grows in the wild, you can then adapt it to growing really well at home.
Huh.
And so I was taking photographs, And this really rather nice Italian gentleman, well, Sardinian, came up and said, excuse me, what are you doing in Sardinian? And I said, I'm so sorry, I only speak English badly. And he sort of looked at me and smiled and said, well, actually, I do speak English. And he said, you're trespassing. I said, oh, I'm so sorry, I was so excited by your myrtles. So he said, oh, well, come back to my house. And I was thinking, stranger. Rule number one, don't get back to strange men's houses. So off I toddled. And he then sat me in his amazing farmhouse kitchen and gave me merlot to drink. It's this amazing liqueur from the freezer, he served it. And it was made from the myrtle berries. And it was just beautiful, like nectar. And then he gave me lunch, which he'd made actually with myrtle, and talked to me all about all how you grill fish on myrtle, you use myrtle in stews and casseroles and everything like this. Anyway, I arrived home rather late to a three looking sad people sitting on the doorstep of the flat that we'd rented, saying, Mum, no food, where are you? And you look like you've been drinking. And which I had, of course. And but myrtle is wonderful, but it's Aphrodite's herb. It's the herb of love. It's the herb that when you go and see the Botticelli and Venus is coming out of the sea,
oh, yeah,
holding the sprig of myrtle in her hand, it is the herb of love. And I'm sure many of your listeners will have seen the wonderful new Duchess of Cambridge with her beautiful bouquet of lilies of the valley, myrtle and white hyacinths.
I didn't realise.
Queen Victoria started this, of having myrtle put in the bouquet. And now all discerning brides must have this sprig of myrtle.
What does it taste like?
It's brilliant. It's spicy. It's warm. It's much warmer, spicier flavour than bay. You don't actually eat the leaf. You use it as an infusion. You infuse the food with the flavour of the leaf. I mean, you could eat the leaf, but yeah, it's a bit chewy.
Well, you know, there's another herb you mentioned in the book that you never see used in cooking. Hyssop?
Oh, Hyssopus officinalis. Now, it's a really ancient herb. Goes back to the Bible, and it's got amazing antiseptic properties. And hyssop's got a bitter tang to it. It's a bitter, minty, thymy flavour. Same family as mint and same family as thyme. And the great thing about bitter is it is a flavour we've lost in our diet. And bitter makes your mouth water, and it actually helps you digest food better. And I use it in marinades, and I use it in stews and casseroles. Mm. I use it in soups. And it gives another dimension to food. It's absolutely fantastic. Wonderful with cream cheese, chopped up fine, and also very good for, you know, if you're making a salsa verde.
Interesting.
But also, forgotten really one important thing. If you grow vegetables, it's really important to grow hyssop, because hyssop's got blue flowers, and bees go to blue before any other colour. And this is just, you know, brilliant for helping pollinate your plants so you get a better yield.
I had no idea. Cheka, this has been just a treat. I hope you're going to come back and visit us again. And
I do look forward to it.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
Again, those amazing bees. Cheka left us with a recipe for hyssop-baked peppers from her book, Cheka's Herb Cookbook. Now, you're going to find it, you know where, on the website, splendidtable.org. And you're going to also find a sneak peek of our new book, How to Eat Weekends. It goes on sale September 20th. We're quite excited here. So take a look, splendidtable.org. Well, today's trivia challenge has been waiting in the wings. Now, the question is, which herb wards off dragon attacks? We're going to return with that answer, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Well, we're going to be talking with you in a moment. You can get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, send us an email. Just go to splendidtable.org or go to the phone, 800-537-5252. But now I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, which herb wards off dragons? Well, basil does, believe it or not. You see, every plant you can imagine has had different meanings. They change with time and location and imagination.
In Greece, basil means king because it grew on an ancient king's tomb. In Romania, they believed the dragon thing. For Italians, it meant love. But elsewhere, if you handed someone a sprig of basil, you were saying you couldn't stand the sight of them. Confusing? Yeah. Now, this is a lot better than one of the maverick takes on the bay leaf. In the social media of long ago, you sent bouquets arranged for their meanings. Bay in the center of a bouquet could mean, you're going to get what you want over my dead body.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late.
Okay, I think it's time to get to the phones. You can call us 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Anything goes. We have got Aaron calling from Mexico. Aaron, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Where are you in Mexico?
Well, actually, at the moment, I'm in El Paso, Texas, but I actually live on the border here. I've been living in Mexico for a couple of years, and I came across a liquor I want to ask you about, actually.
Liquor is not necessarily a forte, but let's go for it.
Yeah, well, I went shopping. I was buying some groceries, and it was on sale. It's called Anís Las Candenas, and it's sweet, and it's strong, and it tastes like licorice, and I don't know what to do with it.
Ah, okay. Well, it's there's I have come to the conclusion almost every country where it is warm has an anise-flavored liqueur of some kind.
Right.
And it's usually sweet, strong, and very powerful in terms of that licorice taste. Well, you know, one thing, I'm thinking in France, there's something called pastis, and it's a similar idea. And one of the things you do is you take a glass of cold water these days with ice, and you pour just a little bit in there, and it becomes like a summer refresher. But in cooking, you could use it anywhere you want that sort of licorice-y flavor. So, for instance, I'm just thinking, let's say you had sautéed a piece of fish, okay?
All right.
And you wanted to do just a light butter sauce. So you'd put some white wine in the pan, and you'd cook that down, scraping up all the nice brown bits, and you'd get a nice pan sauce. And you might swirl in just a little butter. And you would finish it with just like a half teaspoon of the anise. Just to give it, because with seafood, that fennel-y, licorice-y flavor is really delicious, especially with things like scallops and lobster, which of course nobody can afford, but you know what I'm saying, that sweet taste. The other place, believe it or not, that it really works is with things that are rich, like pork. You know, if you're barbecuing pork and you take some really aromatic velvety chilies and use just a little bit of that liqueur, along with grated orange peel and a little orange juice and garlic and oregano. And you could use that as something that you put over pork and then you slowly grill it. I'm thinking especially something like ribs or short ribs.
No, that sounds very interesting. Yeah, I actually hadn't thought about that. I just tried it with coffee.
Well, no, that's a classic way of using it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up, I mean, in at least in our Italian family, something that tasted like anise, you know, it had a lot of names and it came from a lot of parts of Italy. But a tablespoon of that in your coffee was considered to be something that helped you digest
right. And
move on, you know.
Or start the day.
Yes, yes, exactly. It kind of gave you an extra sort of lift, as they would say. You know what? I wonder how that would be mixed into whipped cream. Again, not too much of it.
Right.
Over coffee ice cream? I mean, it's worth a shot.
I'm gonna have to experiment with it, I think.
So. Yeah, I think you should. I think you should. Try the chili idea. I mean, you're obviously in a place where you're going to have incredible access.
Exactly.
And thanks for the question.
Hey, thanks for your advice. Have a great one.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Gina's on the line from Northville, Michigan. Gina, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I would like to talk about menu ideas for my sister-in-law's Italian-themed bridal shower. We're having it at a venue that, I mean, I think we'll have access to a kitchen, but...
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I would like the, you know, just easy stuff, buffet style, stuff that'll hold well, and she is a vegetarian, so some sort of vegetarian option would be great.
How about, when is this going to be?
It was supposed to be in July, but it might be moved to October in Arizona, actually. So
I see.
I'm not sure
it's a movable
yet,
feast. It's a movable feast. And how many people are you talking about?
I would say, I'm going to guess between, 15 and 20, maybe.
Okay.
That's 20 at the top end.
I think, first of all, you've got to have pasta. It's a given, right?
But
there are, and you know, if you want to be really authentic, there's no such thing as a pasta salad in Italy. But in the hot weather, what people do is they make pasta that they serve at room temperature, and they do it with raw sauces. Now, this means you can have the sauce ready to go. You can cook the pasta ahead, and you can combine it. One of the most popular sauces is where you take some lemon juice and garlic. You let that sit in the bottom of a bowl until the garlic is kind of and some chopped onion. Okay.
Mm.
And the idea is you're letting it sit in that lemon juice because the acid is going to get rid of the heat of the garlic and the onion, but you'll still get the flavor. Then what happens is you cut up a lot of tomatoes into small bite-sized pieces. Don't peel them. Don't seed them. Just cut them up.
Okay.
And they go into the bowl. You add salt and pepper. You can add capers. You could add some olives. You could add, cut up hot peppers if you wished, because this is really about what's available. And even in October, in Arizona, I think you're going to still find these things coming in, from local sources. And
mm-hmm.
then what happens is the pasta goes in and you toss it with olive oil to taste. And it's the lemon is just this backdrop. And you can obviously change that to your taste. The last thing you would add, and this would be just before you put it on the table, is a lot of torn up fresh basil. You want you want that to go in at the last minute because when it wilts, it gets dark and that kind of stuff. So that could be one of the dishes. Okay.
Yeah, that sounds great.
And then what I would do is I would do things that are really easy to assemble. You could take a big half sheet pan, stick it in your oven with slices of, these should be cut small. They should be like 2 inches by 2 inches. You want to take good, kind of chewy bread. You rub it with garlic and olive oil. You put that in the oven. You slow toast it so it gets kind of crispy. Now you can set that aside. That can wait a couple of days. And then what you're going to do just before you put everything out or the morning of it is smear on that some fresh goat cheese, and you're going to top it with scallions, and radishes, and you'll drizzle a teeny bit of olive oil over that and coarse salt.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And that, again, that can wait, and it's finger food. Now you could do green beans, a green bean salad that you have little dice of salami in it, little dices of it, and toasted walnuts. And that's really wonderful with oil and a good vinegar, really simple. So you get the idea of what I'm talking about, right?
Oh, yeah. No, this is awesome. This is so great. This takes me in a totally different direction. I was going much more complicated, and this is exactly what I was looking for.
It is going to be fresh, and it can make it look beautiful, and the food is the main event, and you don't have to serve a bit of meat. Nobody's going to miss it.
Oh, yeah. No, that's perfect. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, and congratulations to your sister.
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care.
You too.
Bye. This whole idea of what to do for a big party like that, it's really that what can just sit and what's meant to be served that way, as opposed to fiddling with, doctoring recipes that were never meant to be on a buffet. Anyway, you can reach us, send us an email, splendidtable.org. Jeremy in Sioux City, Iowa, wanted to know, do I have to use raw bones to make stock? Can I just simmer the leftover cooked chicken or the roast? Yeah, you can. Absolutely. The thing is, though, one of the reasons you want some extra meat is you just want to, if you'll pardon the pun, beef up the stock. The meat is going to add more to it. But there is a way of getting around this and saving money. What you can do is use those leftover bones, okay, any scraps of meat that are left, and pile in the vegetables, the onion and the carrot and the celery and the leaves from the celery. And if you do that and then you throw some white wine in the pot, now I'm talking about a cup, okay, and then you add the water and you let it all simmer. Add a little tomato paste and a few drops of fish sauce. Now, why those ingredients? Because they all contain umami. The tomato paste has it, the fish sauce has it, and if you're using, well, you can use white wine if you want a darker one, you use red, but red wine has umami. And umami is this element that lifts other flavors. But the point is, a ton of vegetables with a little bit of mone and a few scraps of meat is going to give you a good broth. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. Let's see. We've got Jason calling from Dublin. Jason, is that Dublin, Ireland?
Yes, it is, Lynn. I am currently working in a restaurant over here, and we do these sandwiches every day, and we use this really great, thick, white bread to use make our sandwiches with. And the only problem that I have is that at the very end of the day, we always have just a load of the pieces that maybe weren't quite good enough to send out,
right,
but they're still really, really delicious and they're great to eat. And we just always have dozens of these extra pieces. And so my question was, I was wondering if you had any recipe suggestions on what I could use leftover bread for, especially if you've got some really exciting bread puddings, because that's where my mind was always going with these things. But maybe you have something
else. Well, you know, bread pudding is great, but I'm thinking of all the ways bread, especially bread that starts to stale, is used.
Mm-hmm.
There's bread salads. Okay, and this is where you'd want to stale that bread. You could toast it in a low oven for quite a while. You want it to be a bit on the crunchy side, and you want it to be on the dry side. And then you could chop up every fresh vegetable you've got, you know, the tomatoes and the cucumbers and the peppers and all that. But you could also do it with greens. You could do it with chunks of marinated onion. And the idea is that you first of all sprinkle the bread with vinegar and a bit of water, and you let it soak, and then you squeeze that out and you dress it with oil and a little more vinegar. And it can be colorful. It can be great on the menu. I mean, it could really be something you could take into any direction. So that's number one. Number two is to take those slices, maybe cut them into, I'm thinking of something like a long rectangles that are maybe 2 inches wide and the length of the slice of bread, and rub those with garlic and a little olive oil, and then toast them. And now you've got bruschetta. You've got bruschetta. I mean, and you could put some cheese on that, run it under the salamander or the broiler, and then that becomes a side for salads and that kind of thing. You could tuck it next to soups. You could put also anything on that. You could do a caper butter, you know, with caper, a bit of garlic, lemon, and butter, and you smear that on there because you've already done a little teeny bit of olive oil and rubbed it with garlic. That could be fabulous.
That sounds really great, especially because everyone here just really loves soup. So a little side for soup or something like that would go really great, I bet.
Oh, that sounds great. Can I ask you, what's the food scene like now in Dublin?
Oh, it's actually kind of exciting. A lot of it's going into kind of fresh food and fresh fruit and really high quality kind of meats and stuff like that are very, very popular around here. But, I mean, it's still got a little bit of the reputation. People do still love their potatoes, that's to say the least. I've learned about 20 different recipes since I've been over here for the past couple of months.
Jason, thanks for the call.
All right, thank you.
Bye. And that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can reach us any way you want. You can follow us on Twitter, connect with us on Facebook, send us an email at splendidtable.org, or phone 800-537-5252. And until next time, let me leave you with this from James Beard, who said, "In a house without a genuine kitchen, one of the delights of growing up is lost." The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. And also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Thanks this week to Johnny Vince Evans for the help with that B-Record. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. We're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.